Tonight we're going to get past the low limitations of our petty narcissisms. There is a world out there. We finished with the convention. It's a very important date today, and I wonder how many people remember it. It's the 65th anniversary of the bombing of Pearl Harbor, an attack that didn't have any signals before it. And what makes it so poignant today is that today the Baker-Hamilton report, the Iraq Study Group report, came out with its recommendations. And there are three major recommendations: a timetable to pull out, bringing in everybody from the European Union to NATO to try to deal with the problem in Iraq, and demands on the Iraqi government, which they can or can't meet, to take more control. But that wasn't what struck me about today. What struck me was James Baker, former Secretary of State, coming out and saying that America has to go hat in hand and talk to Iran. The juxtaposition of these events is just too striking. He drew a parallel saying that, well, when the Soviet Union was the Soviet Union, we talked to them and they wanted to defeat us. And I just thought that that smacked of the worst kind of defeatism, the worst kind of sophomoric sophistry. I don't know what vested interest James Baker is trying to push forward. But to help us shed some light on this, we're very pleased to have Frank Gaffney Jr., the president of the Center for Security Policy from Washington. Frank, thanks for joining us tonight. I know your schedule is really tight.
Hi, it's nice to be with you.
Frank, what do you make of the extemporaneous comments? Let's put aside the specific recommendations of this report, which will be debated. But how does a man like James Baker talk about going to Iran and America having to go to Iran, and comparing talking to Iran to talking to the Soviet Union?
Well, let me come to the second first.
Okay,
this reflects a grave misunderstanding of history and misrepresentation of what Ronald Reagan did with the Soviet Union. Early in his administration, President Reagan set in train.
We should tell our listeners you were an Undersecretary of Defense at the time for security.
Assistant Secretary
for Defense for Security Intelligence, right?
For what was then called Nuclear Forces and Arms Control Policy, and as a Deputy Assistant Secretary, and then International Security Policy as an Assistant Secretary. But during that period, I had some opportunity to see and even participate in a small way, the Reagan strategy for destroying the Soviet Union. It involved a number of steps that I believe we can and must take to destroy Islamofascist sponsoring regimes that are threatening us in much the same way today, except arguably worse.
Frank, can we go through this in just one second? We're taking a quick break out of here, and then we'll be right back to you.
Sure.
And on this 65th anniversary of the bombing of Pearl Harbor, we're privileged to be joined by Frank Gaffney Jr., the founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington. Frank, among other positions that he's held, was Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Nuclear Forces and Arms Control under President Reagan. And we're just discussing what was wrong with what James Baker talked about in terms of America talking to Iran and comparing Iran to the Soviet Union, and what the Reagan administration's policy that was so successful in bringing the Soviet Union to heel, and what could be used against Iran. Frank, I'm sorry for the interruption before. Please continue.
Reagan's strategy was to destroy the Soviet Union, not to perpetuate it. And he set about doing that early in his administration by trying to cut off their funding, by delegitimating them, by empowering those within the Soviet Empire who no longer wanted to be forced to submit to its repression, and through other means, military, neutralizing their advantage, competing through missile defense, for example. These were all techniques that Reagan used very deliberately, and while it is true towards the end of his administration he did enter into negotiations with the Soviets, it was frankly too late to save them, even though people like Jim Baker, I think, quite clearly hoped to do so, to perpetuate them. You had President Bush, who then came in on Reagan's heels, bring his Chicken Kiev speech about how everybody ought to stay within the Soviet Union. This is really a perfect arrangement. That's where Jim Baker, I think, is grievously off base in comparing what he's proposing, which amounts to surrender, seeking to negotiate with an ascendant Iran the terms of our withdrawal in defeat from Iraq. Bears no resemblance at all to what Reagan did at the end of his administration, at the culmination of his successful strategy for defeating the Soviets. This is really part of what I consider to be a grave disservice to the American people that Jim Baker and his team have done. They are packaging our capitulation to Islamo-fascist enemies that are unmistakably and avowedly determined to destroy us, as though this is some sort of realist program for actually advancing our interests or enhancing our security. It's none of that.
There was also a great difference between talking to the Soviet Union and talking to Iran. The Soviet Union may have been a challenge to the Western way of life, but the Soviet Union also had nuclear missiles pointed at us. But the Soviet Union also was not about to engage in a genocide of people. Iran doesn't have that capacity yet. They are not at a par with the United States or any Western country in terms of capability yet, but yet they are saying already, we are going to commit genocide. Now, what do you talk to people like that? We have a leader of our Socialist Party in Canada, Jack Layton, who keeps saying that he wants to talk to the Taliban, and I've had a rhetorical question. Well, what does he want to talk about? Whether they shoot him in the head as a socialist or cut his throat as a trade unionist? That's about, are we at that point now of surrender and submission?
Well, I hope not. You know, President Bush has made it pretty clear, to this point at least, that he will take aboard what Baker and his friends have come up with, but he's not necessarily going to embrace their recommendations. In fact, he's put on the record publicly on a number of different occasions now his strong reservations about, and I think, in fact, opposition to some of these recommendations. So what it's not necessarily the case that our capitulation is an accomplished fact. It's simply the case that Jim Baker and the so-called statesmen that he has assembled in his team and those in Congress and in the press and in the political elite in Washington and, for that matter, in a lot of other capitals that are slavishly embracing and critically thinking that we have something to negotiate with the Iranians other than our surrender, I think are doing a grave disservice to, as I say, the American people and our country.
Frank Gaffney, Jr., I thank you for your time. I know you're hard-pressed for time, and I want to give you the last and last word, and I'm quoting now from an article by Frank just yesterday where he says, an elected, unaccountable, and substantially unqualified commission will formally report what hasn't already been leaked. The title of the commission is the Iraq Study Group. Given the nature of its contribution, a better name would be the Iraq Surrender Group. Frank Gaffney, we thank you for your time, but more than that, we thank you for your reason and your sanity and your service.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Good night. The lines are beginning to light up. Let's go to John.
John? How are you doing?
Good.
A three-part question. I kind of wanted to ask your guest, but I'm sure you can answer this question.
We really wanted to have him on, but he was just he had actually taken some time out and delayed a speech that he had to give tonight.
No, I understand. My question is three-part. I said obviously you're not happy with Baker's comment, so my question is this to you: three parts. One, do you think that the war can be won? Define what winning is, mm-hmm. and at what cost.
Okay, I'll answer each question. It's a very good question. My problem with Baker's comments have less to do with what the group did said about Iraq than what they said about Iran, which were extemporaneous comments. It had nothing to do with Iraq. The study group's recommendations on Iraq were the following, as I said at the top of the hour. Number one, that there be a timetable for withdrawal of 2008, whether realistic or not. That's the recommendation. Number two, that the Iraqi government must do a better job or lose U.S. backing. What they mean by better job, they want the Iraqi government to go in and take out the Shia militias, particularly Muqtada al-Sadr's Mahdi army that's supporting Prime Minister al-Kitrit right now. And the third recommendation is that everybody come to the table, the U.N., NATO, everybody else. Now, going to your question, if Baker had stopped there, fine. Can the war be won? My answer to that, the first part of your question is, it's not a conventional war. What the Americans are trying to do is what the Canadians are trying to do in Afghanistan. It is trying to give a chance to a government to construct and keep the perimeters away from destroying that government. Are they doing it properly? No, because had they listened to the military and put in the number of troops that they had to have put in, maybe there'd be more success. Can it be one in the future? I couldn't tell you. Your second part of your question, what constitutes winning? Having in place a government that is functioning with its own military and not beholden to the militias. Remember, you got to understand why the Shia and Sunni militias are killing each other. Because the prime minister of Iraq is beholden to Muqtada al-Sadr, that famous crazy cleric who said, the Americans think they're liberating us from our religious restrictions. We find liberty in religious restrictions. And it's his Mahdi militia that is causing most of the damage, his Mahdi Shia militia. At what cost? The cost that freedom always has. I think, look, I've said it before and I'll say it again. I may be for the interventions in that part of the world, but I've been critical of the reasons and the manner that President Bush treated the public on these. And John, if you want to stay with us, we've just got to take a short break and I'll explain in full what I mean. You got time?
Okay. Yep.
We'll be right back. And we're in conversation tonight on the Iraq Study Group report that came out, the Baker-Hamilton report, but particularly a very controversial suggestion by Baker that the United States go and talk to Iran. We're talking to John right now, and John posed a series of questions to me about what I thought about Iraq. And here's the conclusion, John, and thank you for being patient with us through the break, because if I don't respond to those gesticulations at 11, at 20, at every minute after, you know, at the ones, this is going to be problems.
I realize that. I do also have a little comment or concern that I want to make is
sure.
That I agree with a lot of what you're saying, Beryl, but what
well, you're going to agree with this. Let me just finish my answer to your question.
Go ahead.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Here's my problem with Bush. And what happened? Bush had to do, and it's very apt to quote this, it's a 65th anniversary of the bombing of Pearl Harbor. We can take lessons from that era. Bush had to have acted like a statesman. He had to have marshaled the English language and taken it out to war. He should have told the people of the world, look, we know that the weapons of mass destruction in the western desert of Iraq have been moved to the eastern desert of Syria. America was told that 3 months before the invasion by Israel. That didn't mean that they shouldn't have done something, because these openings, once you make transparency, you can't turn back the clock. But he should have been honest about it. He should have said, look, we're going in, partly to stabilize the world oil supply. We're also going in because this guy's Saddam is whacking his people 200,000 a year. He's invading other countries. We don't know where he's going to go next. And we want to impose, we know we can't impose democracy, but we want to impose some infrastructures into government that will lead to transparency. But he didn't do that. He rested his case on one thing, and he did the fourth mistake that was bad. We live in an age of instant gratification. We're a Nintendo generation. Winners and losers. He should have explained that this is not about winning, because the enemy can't be seen. It's not about tank divisions on a broad battlefield. It's about nation building. And he didn't have the confidence in himself, nor the confidence in the people to explain that.
I question whether he really knew that or not, too, though.
If he didn't know that, then we've really got a problem.
Yeah, well, I think my concern is from what you just said is that and I'm no expert in the field, but just from my observations of the news and stuff, is that when you go in to try and police a situation which definitely needed some policing, you run into a situation where when you take someone, a totalitarian regime such as Saddam Hussein, and you leave a vacuum there, and then you are trying to create some kind of Western form of democracy, which might or might not work there. I think it's a slippery slope, and I fear
you're absolutely right, John.
We've opened up kind of Pandora's box, and we don't know where we're going.
Well, John,
with this. And my last final comment is, I think what Baker is trying to do is saying, look, you know what, Iran, there's a lot of similar religious beliefs between Iraq and Iran, and that's causing, and I think we need that kind of partnership so that they can control their sects in Iraq. So I think maybe that's what he's
okay.
doing, but I just don't know where this is going to go, and I'm just...
I don't think anybody does, John, but let me respond. I'm sorry for talking quickly because we've got London standing by on the other line. Here's the problem. What was the problem in Iraq? The problem in Iraq is if you're going into police, as you said, to nation build, You don't allow a constitution that allows political parties based on religion. The Iraqi constitution allowed that. It should have been modeled, frankly, on the American constitution. They didn't want to impose it because they were too, it would, believe it or not, you're going to be surprised at this expression, they were too soft on what they were going to do. They should have outlawed parties by religion. That's what's empowered all these fratricidal militias. Number two, on Iran, when a nation is telling you that they want to destroy you, it's not like a game of chess. They want to destroy you because of who you are and what you are. It's not a matter of power. They want to practice genocide. But can you imagine the optics of America going hand in hand to talk to Iran? I will tell you this, and hopefully both you and I will be around in 5 years, that Bush is right twice a day like a broken clock. These openings in Palestine, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, when you've opened the door to transparency in a world that knew none, from the borders of Pakistan to the Moroccan Atlantic coast, you'll never close it again. They'll build their own styles of democracy, but they'll build freedom. John, I got to let you go right now. Thank you for calling. We just got time to say a quick hello before we have to go to another break, but I want to introduce a remarkable guest from London, and Maryam, Namazi, thank you for being very patient with us tonight. We're running a little late. Maryam Namazi is an internationally known campaigner for the rights of women and refugees in Islamic countries, particularly in Iran. She's been a winner of the inaugural Irwin Prize for Secularist of the Year. I don't know where you have time to do anything. What don't you do? You campaign for refugee rights as well, particularly against political Islam. You're a host of TV International. You're a central council member of the Organization of Women's Liberation and director of the International Relations Committee of the Worker Communist Party of Iran, amongst other things. And when we get back after this break, Maryam, you're going to tell us, number one, what we have to talk to Iran about. And number two, where do you get the time in the day even to have an interview? We'll be right back with Maryam Namazi from London. And we're honored to have with us Maryam Namazi, internationally renowned human rights, women's rights campaigner, understands the Islamic world, particularly Iran, member of the Central Committee of the Worker Communist Party of Iran, one of the leading dissident groups. Maryam, let's get right to it. You are ideally qualified to tell us, do we have anything or do we have any reason to make a parallel that James Baker made that, well, we talked to Russia, they wanted to win, to beat us, why can't we talk to Iran? Is there any parallel between the two?
I think there's all this. It's a very different situation, and I think that it's wrong to talk to Iran. And to be quite honest, I think that Iran is very much part of the problem in Iraq, as is, in my opinion, the United States. And I think that talking to them is not really going to get anywhere. And I think it's just, an attempt to provide solutions that are not real solutions. And I think talking to Iran will be in that line, especially when you look at what's happening in Iraq, the rise of the political Islamic movement there, as well as the fact that, we're hearing reports of Sharia law being implemented in many places, the fact that women are no longer safe in Iraq, and with taking all of that into consideration, the fact that Iran has been a key player in arming and supporting the political Islamic movement there, it just makes no sense to talk to them. I think Iran is a regime that should not be talked to under any circumstances. It needs to be, isolated completely politically, again, though I don't agree with any sort of military intervention in Iran or any economic sanctions, I think, because we always have to consider any policy when we are considering policy to see how it affects real live human beings. And I do want to say, though, that and stress the fact that I think the U.S. is just as culpable in the situation in Iraq, in the swamp that's been created there. I think both are actually part of the problem.
It is, as a secularist, I'm very sympathetic to you as a secularist, and I believe in a firewall between faith and state, is one of the mistakes, and we were just talking with our callers and with Frank Gaffney Jr. in Washington about this, is one of the mistakes that America made in its desire to reconstruct Iraq. How do you construct an open, pluralistic society and at the same time allow parties based on religion, and those parties are supported by their own militias, whether Shiite or Sunni? Was that not an almost cataclysmic error from the get-go?
I'm not sure if it's an error. I think It's very much part of, you know, if we can call it the New World Order, where, you know, people are subdivided into a million different categories, primarily starting with religion. Yeah, sorry.
No, I was just about to say, we're going through a debate in Canada with multiculturalism, with pandering to just everything.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's a big, I have a really big problem with multiculturalism, with cultural relativism. I think what it does basically is hold cultures and religions as sacred, when in fact it's the human being that needs to be sacred. And oftentimes, in order to respect the human being, to hold the human being sacred, you actually have to destroy reactionary cultures, reactionary religion.
What you're talking about is the elevation of the individual over any collectivity.
Yeah, I mean, well, elevation of the individual as a human being, as opposed to a fragmented, human being that's first and foremost of X religion, of X ethnicity, of X whatever. Most of these constructed, whereas in fact, what's needed is, you know, to support and defend values and a system that puts the human being first. And I think the problem with Iraq is the fact that these, people's so-called religion, people's so-called ethnicities were put first and foremost rather than the fact that Iraq needs to be a society in which all people are equal, irrespective of what their beliefs are.
And that was done, from my viewpoint, for political expediency, just as in the West, we're bending over backwards, pandering to parochial particularities instead of celebrating universal commonalities for political profit. And correct me if I'm wrong, but you know, I think you and I came to political maturity at the same time, but we came to political maturity at a time when it was precisely a move away from those particularities, when government was treating the individual with its singular consequence more important than any other. And somehow in the past 10, 12, 13 years, North America, Western Europe, the individual became less important. The overriding principles that really were the litmus test of progress of pluralistic liberal societies suddenly went by the wayside in terms of, and were replaced with, well, look what we've done for that group or that group. What caused that shift change?
Well, I mean, I think part of it is the fact that we live in a post-Cold War era, and there is an attempt by the United States to become the sole superpower in a new world order and a new system. And I think that under the system, we're seeing a redefining of many of the values and
priorities of how
that we basically took for granted for a long time.
Marianne, please hold that thought for one moment. We're going to a short break and coming right back with you. And *940, excuse me, for Roger cell phone users, #940 for Bell cell phone users. And you can email us your comments after the show at info@iapm.ca. And we're very honored to be talking to Mariam Namazi, international human rights campaigner, knows Iran, knows the Muslim world, a fighter for women's rights. And Mariam, we were talking before the break of why we're breaking down into celebrating particularities and pandering to each group, and how that's really playing into the hands of both radical Islam, the religious right, you name it, every single group. And you were making a very important point that when it was a bipolar world of the Soviet Union, it was almost as if the West, America, could say, well, okay, this is our cardinal virtue, freedom, the consequence of the individual. You, Soviet Union, you're all about collectivities. Now that the Soviet Union is no longer there, you need a new, what do you need? You need a new platform. So you say, well, our new platform, we're now shifting. We're not celebrating universalities anymore. We're not celebrating our common causes. We're showing you that we can be all things to all people. And that leads to what?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, there are so many issues you raised there. I'm not sure I'll be able to address all of them right here. But I think the problem with this is the fact that what happens is that you know, what's happened is basically religions, cultures have sort of taken on the position of a human being. Now it's the religion or culture that needs to be respected. It needs to be tolerated. It needs to have equality. But there has to be equality between various religions and beliefs and so on and so forth, rather than the human being himself or herself. So what we're seeing, for example, if you criticize Islam, if you criticize the political movement that's associated to it, you know, you're deemed a racist for doing so. And again, it's because you see this very, we're living in a very bizarre times when, you know, it's not racist to, you know, say everybody living in Iran are Muslims, or it's in Islamic world, and therefore it's their right to be living under forced veiling, to be stoned to death, and so on and so forth. But it's racist now to criticize something that's so oppressive and against humanity. But I do want to be clear that I think, for example, the U.S. government has an interest in allowing it to be so, and I think, in a sense, this is the new world order that the U.S. is very much shaping, a world where, you know, the human being has been reduced to practically being worthless. And I think it's a very, very dangerous situation.
So you're saying for different reasons, one on the one hand religious, on the other hand perhaps political, economic, we're going into an era of political correctness that's really not political correctness, but really groupthink and group thought, and everybody marching in nice little almost fascistic order.
I mean, it's basically saying that, you know, anything goes in this day and age, and it's become, we're living in a world now where, you know, you often hear about the fact that, well, it's their culture, it's their religion, you know, and I think part of that helps to excuse the collaboration of various Western governments with oppressive states in the Middle East, for example. On the other hand, it also helps in the Western countries themselves to run, you know, fragmented, regressive ghettos and so-called minority communities.
Divide and conquer.
Very on the cheap, exactly, and just say, well, you know, it's not my problem that there are honor killings, that, you know, people are segregated in Stop the War Coalition meetings in Britain. Women aren't allowed in certain mosques in Britain. There are faith schools. There's a demand for a Sharia court, for example. We know about what happened in Canada as well as in other places. So, you know, you see this complete revising of basic values. And I want to add here that I don't think they're Western values. I think they're human values. They're universal values. They've been fought for, wherever they've been fought for, they belong to all of humanity. And I think it's important that we, you know, begin to stand up for these values and say that we're not going to accept a world in which the human being is worthless.
We shall not go gently into that good night. Mariam Namazi, I want to thank you and wish you a good night.
Thank you
and
very much.
I want to encourage everybody to go to your website, Mariam Namazi, and I'm going to spell the name MariamNamazie.com. You will find wisdom there. Mariam, thank you very much for your courage and your eloquence.
Thanks very much for having me on your
program.
Take care.
Bye. And we're still in London. Colonel Peter Reynolds, dear friend, thank you. We've been running late. We've had our lines filled. I want to tell our listeners, this is a fellow that knows whereof he speaks. Former director of Public Affairs Office of NATO in Belgium. He was senior advisor to UNOPS, the United Nations office that was overseeing the Iraq elections. And he gave testimony to the commission that ended up doing the Baker-Hamilton report.
Not quite.
Well, to the Congressional Committee.
I talked to some of the staffers.
Right. And the Congressional Committee hearings. Then, but you did get a great email. That you can share with us.
No, I sent out a great email saying that I'm glad that the committee took note of the presentation I gave not only at the Ritz in Montreal, which you kindly sponsored with your institute, but also to various audiences in the United States, that some of the conclusions, most of the conclusions, that actually I had identified at some stage earlier this year, apart from the timescale of withdrawal and things like that.
Baker Hamilton report, there's a lot of generalities in there aside from the timetable. They want Iraq to take more control. How they're going to control the militias, they haven't said. They want everybody around the table. But I want you to think of what's really bugging me tonight. 65th anniversary of Pearl Harbor, we've got James Baker saying America's got to go hat in hand and talk to Iran because they talked to the Soviet Union. And I want you to enlighten me if there's any parallel there right after this short break. And tonight we're examining the Baker-Hamilton Commission report, the Iraq Study Group. Our very special guest from London, who's been very patient with us tonight, Colonel Peter Reynolds, former senior advisor to the United, to UNOPS, overseeing the Iraqi elections. This man knows this area as well as anybody in the world. And Peter, I asked you before the break, tell me about Baker's extemporaneous comments about talking to Iran, America going hat in hand.
I think he, like everybody else, has realized it's a very complex area. Whether you actually include it into the Greater Middle East Peace Plan or whatever it is, I have no idea. One of the fundamental problems I have with the way that Iraq has been addressed over the last few years is there's been a bit of a short-sightedness about what the milestones are, how we get from A to B. What the hell is B? What are we aiming for at the end of the day? What your caller earlier on, who I listened to on the internet, mm-hmm. identified the problem and said, you know, what does winning mean?
I gave him an answer. Winning should be nation building, but you can't nation build when you're tied to religion.
Militaries don't nation build. Militaries are bloody good at knocking things down and killing people. That's what they get paid for.
Militaries also can protect the political infrastructure that's been built up while they're being protected, but they're not any good at all if there's nothing in the government to build.
Correct. So you have to have other people in. Now, we're obviously short of a few other people. Where are the experts? Where are the reconstruction experts and things like that? Well, most of those guys and girls are earning their money in civil society, working for large companies, corporations, you know, whose job it is to build power stations, things like that. It's not a military type thing. It's not a USAID or a DFID type thing. So those people should be involved.
But many of those people are involved, and there are gauges of infrastructure success, internal success in Iraq, in terms of women's education, girls going to school, hospitals operating. The problem seems to be having a stable government. But how could you have a stable government when you have people within that government tied and beholden to military militias, religious-based military militias, and have the leaders of those religious groups in your government?
Can't disagree with you on any of those points at all. Really can't. And, you know, if you were a cynic, you'd say, bring back the good old days. Let's have a bit of benevolent dictatorships and some harsh rule at the top to, you know, at least focus people in the right direction. And maybe we can go down the full democratization route the further on down the line. But we should not step back from equal education for all those hospitals, all the rest of it. You know, that's a really, really, really difficult thing.
Now, you know that area really well. Why do you think Baker made the parallel between talking to Iran and talking to the Soviet Union? They're not at all similar. The Soviet Union did not want genocide against the world. The Soviet Union was also a power with 7,000 nuclear missiles aimed at the West. There was mutually assured deterrence. Iran doesn't have that power yet. Iran wants to make genocide. Why would a James Baker make that parallel?
He's a very experienced diplomat, but
it's like my question to Jack Layton, who wants to talk to the Taliban. What do you talk to him about? Whether you're shot in the head as a socialist or have your throat cut as a trade unionist. Everybody we've had on tonight, from the right wing to the left wing, whether they agree or disagree with American policy in Iraq, has said the same thing. Don't talk to Iran, because that's going to be seen in the radical Islamic world as capitulation. And they won't talk back.
Absolutely. Can't disagree with you there. That's the chance you'd take by talking to tourists. But the British government did it with the IRA, and goodness knows, ex-IRA members are now...
I don't think we can compare the IRA to the radical Islamists.
Just hear me out. I mean, you know, if you're going to keep your friends close, keep your enemy closer as well. And the way to get close to them is to talk to them about, I don't know,
What do we talk to Iran about? Do we talk to Iran about which country will offer up? Here, take Israel. Wipe out the 6 million Jews and we'll sit around the table. Well, you know, we'll give you a little offering from Europe. Take Greece. You know, we got this conversation, and you know where it brings us back to, don't you, Peter?
Absolutely.
It brings us back to Winston Churchill's famous statement. Besides the one of victory at all costs, a victory despite all terror, An appeaser is someone who feeds the crocodile, hoping he'll eat him last, but eat him he shall. Peter Reynolds, we're going to continue this next week with you. We've run straight out of time. I thank you for your patience and your time and your wisdom and your service to your country and to the world.
Have a great evening. Bye.
Take care. Nick Mays of Master Control, thanks very much. Montreal, Canada, we'll be back with you on Monday.